small wins are exactly what they sound like and are part of how keystone habits create widespread changes. A huge body of research has shown that small wins have enormous power and influence disproportionate to the accomplishments of the victories themselves. Small wins are a steady application of a small advantage, one Cornell professor wrote in 1984. Once a small win has been accomplished, forces are set in motion that favor another small win. Small wins fuel transformative changes by leveraging tiny advantages into patterns that convince people that bigger achievements are within reach. For example, when gay rights organizations started campaigning against homophobia in the late 1960s, their initial efforts yielded only a string of failures. They pushed to repeal laws used to prosecute gays and were roundly defeated in state legislatures. Teachers tried to create curriculums to counsel gay teens and were fired for suggesting that homosexuality should be embraced. It seemed like the gay community's larger goals, ending discrimination and police harassment, convincing the American Psychiatric Association to stop defining homosexuality as a mental disease, were out of reach. Then, in the early 1970s, the American Library Association's Task Force on Gay Liberation decided to focus on one modest goal: convincing the Library of Congress to reclassify books about the gay liberation movement from HQ 71-471, Abnormal Sexual Relations, Including Sexual Crimes, to another, less pejorative category. In 1972, after receiving a letter requesting the reclassification, the Library of Congress agreed to make the shift, reclassifying books into a newly created category, HQ 76.5, Homosexuality, Lesbianism, Gay Liberation Movement, Homophile Movement. It was a minor tweak of an old institutional habit regarding how books were shelved, but the effect was electrifying. News of the new policy spread across the nation. Gay rights organizations, citing the victory, started fundraising drives. Within a few years, openly gay politicians were running for political office in California, New York, Massachusetts, and Oregon, many of them citing the Library of Congress's decision as inspiration. In 1973, the American Psychiatric Association, after years of internal debate, rewrote the definition of homosexuality so it was no longer a mental illness, paving the way for the passage of state laws that made it illegal to discriminate against people because of their sexual orientation. And it all began with one small win. Small wins do not combine in a neat, linear, serial form, with each step being a demonstrable step closer to some predetermined goal, wrote Carl Weick, a prominent organizational psychologist. More common is the circumstance where small wins are scattered, like miniature experiments that test implicit theories about resistance and opportunity, and uncover both resources and barriers that were invisible before the situation was stirred up. Which is precisely what happened with Michael Phelps. When Bob Bowman started working with Phelps and his mother on the keystone habits of visualization and relaxation, neither Bowman nor Phelps had any idea what they were doing. "We'd experiment, try different things until we found stuff that worked," Bowman told me. "Eventually, we figured out it was best to concentrate on these tiny moments of success and build them into mental triggers. We work them into a routine. There's a series of things we do before every race that are designed to give Michael a sense of building victory. If you were to ask Michael what's going on in his head before competition, he would say he's not really thinking about anything. He's just following the program. But that's not right. It's more like his habits have taken over. When the race arrives, he's more than halfway through his plan, and he's been victorious at every step. All the stretches went like he planned. The warm-up laps were just like he visualized. His headphones are playing exactly what he expected. The actual race is just another step in a pattern that started earlier that day and has been nothing but victories. Winning is a natural extension. Back in Beijing, it was 9:56 a.m., 4 minutes before the race's start, and Phelps stood behind his starting block, bouncing slightly on his toes. When the announcer said his name, Phelps stepped onto the block, as he always did before a race, and then stepped down, as he always did. He swung his arms 3 times, as he had before every race since he was 12 years old. He stepped up on the blocks again, got into his stance, and when the guns sounded, leapt. Phelps knew that something was wrong as soon as he hit the water. There was moisture inside his goggles. He couldn't tell if they were leaking from the top or bottom. But as he broke the water's surface and began swimming, he hoped the leak wouldn't become too bad. By the second turn, however, everything was getting blurry. As he approached the third turn and final lap, the cups of his goggles were completely filled. Phelps couldn't see anything. Not the line along the pool's bottom, not the black tee marking the approaching wall. He couldn't see how many strokes were left. For most swimmers, losing your sight in the middle of an Olympic final would be cause for panic. Phelps was calm. Everything else that day had gone according to plan. The leaking goggles were a minor deviation, but one for which he was prepared. Bowman had once made Phelps swim in a Michigan pool in the dark, believing that he needed to be ready for any surprise. Some of the videotapes in Phelps' mind had featured problems like this. He had mentally rehearsed how he would respond to a goggle failure. As he started his last lap, Phelps estimated how many strokes the final push would require, 19 or 20, maybe 21, and started counting. He felt totally relaxed as he swam at full strength. Midway through the lap, he began to increase his effort, a final eruption that had become one of his main techniques in overwhelming opponents. At 18 strokes, he started anticipating the wall. He could hear the crowd roaring, but since he was blind, he had no idea if they were cheering for him or someone else. 19 strokes, then 20. It felt like he needed one more. That's what the videotape in his head said. He made a 21st huge stroke, glided with his arm outstretched, and touched the wall. He had timed it perfectly. When he ripped off his goggles and looked up at the scoreboard, it said WR, World Record, next to his name. He'd won another gold. After the race, a reporter asked what it had felt like to swim blind. It felt like I imagined it would, Phelps said. It was one additional victory in a lifetime full of small wins.